Check with your company's human resources or accounting departments to find out if your employer matches charitable contributions, then request a matching gift form. For more information on companies making matching gifts, go to kboo.fm/employer matching.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Again, you're tuned to Hard Knock here on the Pacifica Network. My next guest has shared the stage with household names like Trevor Noah, Roy Wood Jr., and Gina Yashere. Her latest project is the debut comedy album, Black and Blue. I'm talking about the one and only, the very funny and talented Corinda Dobbins. Corinda, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. Now, before we jump into discussing the album, I want to give our listening family a bit more insight to who you are. You know, Corinda was born and raised in Detroit, where she got her start being a comedian, as her family would like to say, since childhood. She started doing jokes on stage about 12 years ago at an open mic in Oakland, California, on a light dare from a friend. Now, Corinda, I want you to take us back to that dare. Like, as kids, we're told or we're asked, if a friend dares you to jump off a bridge, would you jump too? And the idea of being that it's not wise to be pressured by someone to do something that you might not otherwise thought to do. Now, of course, an open mic isn't a bridge, but the experience, I'm sure at first had some element of fear associated with it, perhaps. Describe for our listeners that moment you took the stage on a dare.
Absolutely. I had a friend who asked me if she found the open mic, if I would do it. And of course I said yes, because I never thought that she would find it. But when she did, of course I couldn't be flaky. I couldn't back out. So I wrote for about a month, and I took the stage at Woody's in Oakland, California, March 19th, 2010. So that was... it was scary. I was the only comic to sign up that night, which has never happened before or since, I'm sure, in the comedy world. So it was, I did 10 minutes, my first time ever being on stage. That's kind of unheard of. Usually you do 2 or 3 minutes.
And you survived the whole 10 minutes.
I did.
Before we talk further about this open mic, where is that friend now, and have they hinted to receiving a small percentage of royalties from the comedy album?
Actually, you know, she is the only one of my friends who has not asked for a percentage of my comedy album. It's like the one who should be isn't, and everyone else is kind of like, wait a minute. I think you told a joke about me in 2012, so where's my check?
Right. Going back to being on stage, especially open mics, they're not for the weak-hearted. How has the navigation of these spaces helped you to hone your craft as a comedian?
You said it exactly right. They are not for the weak, or It's a rough road, open mics. Everybody who's starting out, like, this is where you have to go to get good. But unfortunately, we're not good yet, and so you're sitting through hours and hours of horrible comedy.
Right.
But you know, as you get better, you start to do showcases and things that pay you a little bit of money. So the open mics got, you know, fewer and fewer between, and you know, and luckily, I haven't done an open mic in a really long time.
The open mic seems kind of like a hardcore Chitlin circuit. Like, you have to do not just one, but a bunch at a bunch of different places. Maybe you can talk a bit more about that, because if people haven't experienced it, it's a world into itself of its own.
Yeah, I'm not in Oakland anymore. I'm in LA. But when I was in Oakland, you had to make out like a schedule for the week, because there was like an open mic on Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday morning. You know, it was just this web of open mics you had to try to hit. But also you had to get there and sign up, because they only take so many fledgling comedians. So you have to get there early. You have to sign up. And then you have to wait around for an hour or two. And then maybe sometimes you might go to two or three open mics in a night. And so you have to start that process all over again. So it's very daunting, and you have to want to do it
right,
really badly in order to survive.
It's a hard grind. It's a hard grind. I know a couple of comedians. But based right now on what's happening in the world of comedy, your timing seems perfect, or at least extremely ideal. With the successes of comics like Yvonne Orji, Amanda Seals, Robin Thede with the Black Lady Sketch Show, Z-Way, Nicole Byer, Sam J, Gina Yashere, Tiffany Haddish, all have been in the game for a while, but now doors have opened more widely for women, and in particular Black women, to take center stage. We're talking about comedy specials on HBO, Netflix, Showtime. Before, it was like only a handful.
Yeah,
that would receive this type of shine. People like Wanda Sykes, of course, or Whoopi Goldberg,
right,
or Monique.
Right.
What would you attribute to this being this major change and shift in these type of platforms seeing the commodity or the potential in showcasing these Black women who are all extremely talented, but in the past would not have received the same opportunity?
I think what you're seeing right now is sort of a confluence of things happening at one time. I think Insecure gave Amanda and Yvonne an opportunity to step out and do stand-up comedy with a much higher platform.
Mm-hmm.
And Gina Yashere, also her television show at CBS, has given her a much higher platform. I think what you're seeing is the culmination of Black women working really hard and getting to a place, and now they have to give us the opportunities, right? So it's like, once you get to a certain level, they're like, you have this many followers, you have this much fame, we're going to give you a special, we're going to give you an album, we're going to give you all the things, right? And I think it's like a little Black woman wave, and I'm ready to ride it.
Absolutely. And I also want to add to that is that what I've noticed is these Black women are in the space of not just being the talent, but also the producers, and are putting each other on. Like with,
yes,
you know, Issa Rae and, you know, Robin Thede, or with Tiffany Haddish being like, I'm going to do a whole entire Netflix special and I put on women of color, in particular Black women.
I mean, it's so incredible to me, because you don't always have that, you know, a woman who has a platform who's willing to share it. And so, shout out to Tiffany, and also Wanda did the same thing. She had a special a couple of years ago where she put women on who she thought was really funny. And, you know, sometimes that's the only way we can make it. If someone more famous says, hey, I think this person is funny, I want to give her an opportunity. And so kudos to them for doing that, because they don't have to.
Now, in your act, you use some of the racism you've experienced in your life. Many experiences that can be viewed as absurd or highly offensive in nature. What's the process for you as a comedian turning the absurd or the bad into something funny? And I say that looking at the CD, Black and Blue, where you talked about not my Harriet. There's something that you said in there where I just had to write down. It was like made out of leather. and contradictions. Maybe you can talk a bit about your process of creating as an artist.
I started writing that joke when I heard that they were going to put Andrew Jackson on the back of the $20 bill and put Harriet on the front. And I said, this is preposterous. Well, first I was angry. And then I moved to start to write something funny. And that's usually my process for me. A lot of times when I experience racism or homophobia or misogyny, whatever it may be, it usually starts from a place of anger. And then I say, how can I turn this into a joke? And sometimes I can't, because when you're really angry about something, that joke is not going to come off well on stage. Mm. You have to have some time to let it marinate, you know, let it sink in, you know. So a lot of the times when I experience those kinds of things, that's my process.
And speaking of those contradictions, let's listen to track 9, Not My Harriet, off of the brand new CD, debut CD, from Corinda Dobbins, Black and Blue.
Black women trying to hurry up and get Harriet on that $20 bill. They said it might take till 2030. Black women's like, no. But I don't know how I feel about that. I don't know how I feel about Harriet being on the $20 bill. Because on one hand, I get it. In this country, when you do great things, they want to try to put you on money. You know what I mean? That's how they memorialize you. But on the other hand, Harriet was fighting for Black people not to be a type of currency, so I don't know how she would feel about being on money. You know, and I don't want people throwing Harriets at the strip club. I don't want that. I don't want people using Harriets for the drug deal. You know what I mean? That's disrespectful. I don't want rappers talking about dead Harriets. Like, I don't want that. How about we put Harriet on a coin? Let's do that. Let's put Harriet on a coin. You know why? You know what people do with coins? They polish it. They put it in a little sleeve. And they put it in the drawer. They keep her safe. That's what I want for Harriet. That's what I want. And they're talking about putting Andrew Jackson on the back, putting Harriet on the front. No. That's what we're not going to do. Yeah, you're going to put a white dude on the back. Harriet got to watch her back the whole time she on the $20 bill. Y'all gonna have to find a picture of Harriet running like this, like have a pair of Air Jacksons on, just like made out of leather and contradictions. I don't know. I was single for a long time, and I'm sure you guys know why. I wanted a woman who didn't have a pet. That's a tough go. But I finally found a woman who didn't have a pet. As soon as she told me she didn't have a pet, like, I just dropped down to one knee. I was like, you're the one for me. I don't know if we're ever going to get married, but I don't know. I don't like lesbian weddings. Because they're all outside in the woods. So I don't like that. It's cold. Every lesbian wedding I've been to has been in the woods. And they're very long. They all start out something like this, like you're walking in, and they're like, yes, Tracy, please start reading the 300-word passage from the little-known 19th century feminist we've never heard of. Go. Uh-huh. And then after you're done, please start the 3-hour African drum circle. And their vows always start out like this. We met. Our souls met 1,000 years ago in another lifetime. But I knew our souls would meet again in this one. And I'm like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? Like, I crawl out of every lesbian wedding looking like Leonardo DiCaprio from The Revenant. It's just a beard. Crawling out of that shallow gray. I got a bear coat on me. Like, oh, what year is it? It's cold.
Now, you're a Black woman, you're a mother, and you're a lesbian navigating this comedy scene. But going back into what we just heard, I feel like only a lesbian could talk about that. I think any, I want to let people know, listeners, anyone else saying, commenting about that, it would be extremely offensive, but you found the humor in that. And I think the humor is because some of it is really honest. Maybe if you can talk a bit about that.
It's 100% honest. As you know, lesbians, we enjoy the outdoors. And so many things that we do happen out there. And I don't necessarily like it so much. It's especially when it's in the Redwoods and it's 30 degrees and everybody's standing around freezing and we got to pretend like, you know, it's not freezing. So I was just really pleading to my lesbian sisters, like, you know, we can go indoors. There's nothing wrong with it. We can be warm. We can be cozy. We can be toasty. We don't have to do everything in the roughage.
Talk a bit about, you know, because I'm a self-identified queer Black woman. For me, hearing hiking while Black, I was like, I still can't get into the hiking myself. I've tried it. But I'm like, right now, why does that have to be like so associated with the queerness moment? And then also there's the struggle for me as, because my former partner, major hiking thing. That was her thing. Like, she left the country to hike. I'm like, this is really interesting. And it's really costly. It's not a cheap thing. It's not a cheap hobby, right?
It is not.
Talk a bit about why you found hiking while Black so interesting and important, including in your comedy.
You know what? When I told my family back in Detroit that I was hiking, they were not here for it. Like, my mom was like, that doesn't sound like you. And it absolutely did not sound like me. I was so anti-hiking. But you know what happened is during COVID, and it was one of the few ways that I could exercise and get out and enjoy nature. And so I have a friend who's a lesbian, who's also Black, and she has a house kind of like up in the hills, and there's a trail that we would follow and that we would, and I was like, oh, this isn't so bad, you know? My experience in the woods had been, you know, at weddings, lesbian weddings in the cold, but you know, these nice trails in LA, nice warm sunny day.
Right.
I'm like, this is not so bad. But like you said, it's not cheap. I went to REI and I was like $300 lighter when I walked out of there with my hiking gear.
Right. And then also being it's not a prerequisite to being a lesbian. I mean, because I'm starting to feel like it is, but it's not, right?
It's one of those things. It's hiking and it's pets. And I really didn't do either one. So I was already on the outside looking in with my lesbian friends. They were like, we don't know about you.
Yeah.
So I still don't have a pet. But I'm doing hiking, so I feel like, you know, I'm 50% my lesbian card is like 50% like you
know. I was like, they're not gonna revoke
it's halfway cut up.
All right. Again, I'm speaking with comedian Corinda Dobbins. She just released a brand new comedy album titled Black and Blue. Let's listen to some more material off of the album Black and Blue, looking at the whole hiking experience.
During COVID, I had to come out to my family as a hiker. And they were not supportive of my lifestyle choice at all. Like, they didn't like it. It's not that Black people don't like being in the woods or hiking or nature. It's just like, they don't like you putting yourself in danger unnecessarily, you know? As soon as I told them I needed a bear whistle, they was like, hold up, no. No, 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 no. But when I went into REI, there was a Black guy who, he very quickly approached me. He's like, oh my God, I'm so glad you're here. I was like, really? He's like, oh yes, what do you need? I was like, I don't know, I'm starting to hike. I probably need some stuff. I probably need a knife, you know, bear whistle. He's like, you need a knife? What kind of knife do you think you need? I'm like, I don't know. You tell me, sir. He's like, I think you need a fixed knife so you can build shelter. I was like, you think I can build shelter? I feel so seen right now. I was like, you think I can build something? I was like, not unless there's a Ross REI in the woods. I don't think I can build shelter. And I immediately left that REI and I went to my friend's house, and there were like three Black women there who were like over 60, and I was telling them that I that I hike. And they were like, why are you doing that? I was like, you know, trying to, you know, get into nature. And it's like, these women had never hiked before in their lives, but they told me everything I need to survive. You guys need to listen to black women. I was like, what do I need? It was like, you need a hot water bottle. You need some Vaseline and some hot sauce. I was like, that's it? That's all I need? It was like, yeah. You know, the hot water bottle in case you injure yourself, you know, prop your limbs up, you know, some Vaseline for the bears. I was like, how's that gonna help me with bears? They was like, well, you make a little Vaseline circle. And then if he come chasing you, you know, he just slip on it. I was like, okay. And if he don't, that's what the hot sauce is for. Like, you fling it in his eye. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, either that's gonna work or I'm gonna just die a real slippery death. Like, I don't know which one. Like, how did she die? She was covered in Vaseline and hot sauce. Like, and the bear was just licking her. Like, it was.
And again, this is Hard Knock Radio here on the Pacifica Network. I'm speaking with Corinda Dobbins, comedian Corinda Dobbins. She just released her brand new comedy album, Black and Blue, today. Something else from the album that had me laughing really, really hard was Old Oakland versus New Oakland. hilarious material, especially the yoga, you know, the side chick in your life. You know, I was like, you were saying certain things, and I was like, where is this woman at? Because it was resonating.
I love that class. I love that class. And so many people, when I said that I go to trap yoga, they were like, that don't sound right, Corinda. I was like, this class is amazing. Like, this is a black woman who studied in India, so she's legit, you know.
Right.
This ain't no bootleg yoga. This is like real deal yoga, just, you know, with rap music. And it's that class is so hype. It is amazing. And I encourage anybody to find Trap Yoga Bay and go to her class.
Black women out here doing all kind of stuff we don't think they would be doing. I injured myself last year, and I'm sure you know, if you injure yourself in California, you got to do yoga. Like, that's, I think that's in the charter of the state. And I was like, I don't want to do yoga. But I had to find a yoga class that speaks to my heart. So I do trap yoga. A lot of people was like, trap yoga, that doesn't sound like that go together. But you didn't think sushi and burrito went together either, but you probably have one every day. You know, sushi burrito. I love trap yoga. My teacher, she's from Oakland, but she studied in India, so she's a certified vinyasa yoga instructor. But her class is styled out a little different, you know what I mean? Like, she's walking around surveying the class. She's like, this class is about to be real f***ing hard. And she's giving you little ratchet affirmations in between your yoga stances. You like coming up out of Young Cobra or whatever, and she's like, I want you to stay loose. I'm like, okay, I'm staying loose. She's like, I want you to bend over. I'm like, oh, well, righty. She's like, I want you to look over your left shoulder. I was like, oh, what's over my left shoulder? She's like, I want you to look over your left shoulder, and I want you to say goodbye to being a side chick in your own life. I was like, oh my God, I always should have been in this class. You coming up out of the next dance, and she's like, I still want you to stay loose. I'm like, okay, I'm staying loose. She's like, I want you to bend over again. I'm like, all righty. She's like, but this time I want you to look over your right shoulder. I'm like, oh, what's over my right shoulder? She said, I want you to look over your right shoulder, and I want you to say goodbye to all the you let slide. I was like, lady, I don't even know you, but you seeing right through me. It's very uncomfortable. It's very uncomfortable. But my favorite is, I was trying to do upward facing dog. I'm sure you guys know it's kind of difficult to do upward facing dog. And this is how I was doing it. I was like, she was like, that ain't it. I was like, but I'm trying though. And for some reason, I just started grunting even though I was doing the position wrong. And I was like, She was like, I want you to bend over backwards for your self for once. I was like, oh! Almost broke my spine for that lady. I love that class.
You're tuned to Hard Knock. I'm speaking with Corinda Dobbins. We're discussing her latest project, the brand new CD, Black and Blue. In closing, you know, we're about to wrap up this conversation. I had a really good time speaking with you. But talk a bit about your relationship with Blonde Medicine. How did you all come to connect? Because, you know, like, they're based out here, but you're mm-hmm. now in L.A. What's mm-hmm. How was the connection? What was the relationship?
You know, I have known Dominic for a really long time, who owns the label of Blonde Medicine. He used to work for another company, but then he started his own label. And my friend and my friend Dia and I, we produced shows together, and you know, we came to them with this idea of recording our first albums together. And we actually wanted to do it a year and a half ago, but you know, COVID had other ideas, and so we pushed it out and we recorded it in San Francisco, and we just had an amazing time. Dia and I have a shared audience, and so we had a lot of Black and Brown people. In San Francisco, you know, we turned it out, and it was really important for us to take that next step in our careers together. And we were just glad that our fans could share that moment with us.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of your material is, you know, it was recorded here in San Francisco, California, but you've since moved to mm-hmm. Los Angeles. How's L.A., La La Land? How has that been treating you?
I love L.A., but it's different. It's very different. I used to get paid for comedy shows, and now I don't. But it's definitely a move you have to make, because all of the industry is in LA or New York. And so if you want to take your career to the next level, you really have to go to that space and try to carve out a name for yourself there. And I love LA. I'm hiking. I'm eating seaweed and gluten-free cheesecake and buffalo cauliflower. You know, when you move to LA, you gotta get your physical health together, because a lot of people, it's, you know, you're going on auditions and people, you know, they want to see you fit and they want to see you at your best. So I've been doing a lot of physical activity.
Got you. Backing up a bit, you know, at the start of the conversation, I mentioned that your family said you've been doing comedy since childhood. What did they say to you when you were like, hey, you know, because a lot of your comedy is really smart, very intelligent.
Thank you.
So the thought is that she's a very intelligent person in her professional as well as private life. But to tell your family that, you know, I'm going to pursue this dream that now I'm not even getting paid for in the moment, right? What was the conversation, especially with your daughter? What's been the conversation with your family and friends?
Well, it depends on which generation I was talking to. If I'm talking to my grandmother and like my aunts, and the first thing they said was, don't quit your day job. You know, this is something that you need to do on the side, you know, just as a hustle or something that you enjoy, but you still need to make money. And my daughter and my mom and, you know, some of my cousins, they were like, hey, you know, that's a great idea. You know, you've always been funny in the family, you know, go for it. But I think when I absolutely pursued it full time, I think then maybe it might have been a concern. So like, how you gonna make money? You know, you still gotta pay bills. So I think they believed in me, but they're also practical, right? They're like, what are you gonna do to make sure that your lifestyle stays at the same level? And so I was like, I gotta go hard or go home. I never want to have any regrets. I don't want to say maybe if I tried or didn't try, you know, I have to pursue this dream. If I don't make it, you know, I can always go back to working in biotech or 9-to-5 and doing those things. But, you know, I gotta try and make this a career.
Connecting it to the CD, Corinda, what would those three older Black women say, the ones that advise you to have Vaseline when you're hiking, what do you think they would say about your decision in this moment? Or have you talked to them about it at all? Because, you know, you got to listen to Black women, as you said, on the CD.
I absolutely have to listen to them. I think they would say that as long as you have Vaseline, you know, as Black people, that's a cure-all. Like, if you have Vaseline, you can make it. You can slide your way into anything. So take it and make it happen for yourself.
Right, right. That is some Vicks, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's the truth. That is some Vicks. I mean, it cures everything.
It's those two things. They cure all, right? Right? You know, it's like, even if they don't have the experience in that particular thing, they like, we know these three things work wherever, for whatever. I don't care if it's a bear. If it's what it's gonna work, just use it.
Yeah, for real. I'm so serious. So this is the last question. In closing, how can the listening family of Hard Knock check you out and also get the new CD, Black and Bloom?
They can go to blondmedicine.com. They can also go to my website, CorindaDobbins.com, and they can order the digital tracks, or they can also get the LP. I recommend getting the album. You know, it's really cool. It's actually black and blue. So, you know, I had to keep the theme running. It's going to be dope.
And what else is next for you? I mean, like, you mentioned you're in LA. What's next for you? Is there other things you're working on and, you know, things that you're willing to talk a bit about right now?
Well, I'm doing some writing right now. I'm hoping that I can get staffed on a show in LA, and also I want to get out and tour and support this new album. Obviously that depends a lot on the variant situation with COVID, but I really want to go out on the road and support this project.
All right, again, Corinda Dobbins, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today here on Hard Knock.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a blast.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock, radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on, check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost for the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat till it ain't from the steel grave beats. They bleed. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to the lovers I name with a please. Maybe some shade on your name in the street. Let's go. Hey, it ain't David D.
Real Talk Radio. You and I rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
Cracks in the abode of death. Few people really know the nature of death rows. It is used as a political prop by politicians and is thus a stepping stone to their gateway of power. But death row is really far more than that. It is a place where men and women, and until recently, even juveniles, were sent to live and die in aching loneliness and despair. That's because death row was specifically designed to isolate people physically and psychologically. On death row, American law reconstructed a caste of the untouchables where no one was allowed to touch you. Not a child, not a parent, not even one's very spouse. But that's not all. You were even isolated from other people on death row. You were in solitary confinement, locked in a cell, alone, for 23 hours a day, until you were executed or left death row. Many, perhaps most men, spent decades under such conditions. Why? Because the state, by creating such extreme conditions, sought to make people into a kind of living dead, so broken that actual death will be but a relief. That fever seems to be breaking, at least in Pennsylvania. Here, today, is a much smaller death row, where the number has fallen to around 100. And men spend over 8 hours a day out of their cells. They have contact visits. Now, the state will no longer sign death warrants and is seeking the abolition of the death penalty. The tide seems to have turned. And death row is no longer the death row of cruel memory. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Hard Knocks Radio, rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
And my last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
And again, you're tuned to Hard Knock here on the Pacifica Network. Up next, I'm joined by Claudia Walker, the author of the ABCs of the HBCUs, the first ABC book dedicated to historically black colleges and universities, from FAMU to Howard, the Divine Nine to Battles of the Bands. Children learn about the love, lifestyles, and legacies that built these incredible institutions and traditions. Claudia Walker, welcome to Hard Knock Radio, and thank you so much for putting together this book.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Now, of course, you know, it's definitely a pleasure to have you here, and the book itself for children has been characterized as a front row, all-inclusive tour of historically black colleges and universities. What is an historically black college or university? How many exist? And what is the Divine Nine organizations?
Sure. So HBCUs, or historically black colleges and universities, are colleges that existed during the time when, actually before slavery was actually outlawed. So before enslaved people were emancipated, you had these schools that were popping up in the South as a way to educate either those who were recently enslaved or recently emancipated from slavery, or those who were born free or had gotten their freedom through, you know, some other avenue. And so it was an opportunity for Black people to get educated, because as we know, in that time, there were no other options. Black people were not allowed to attend any other type of higher education institution. And in fact, at the time, if an African-American person was found reading, that was something that was illegal. So there could be really dire consequences if Black folks were found, you know, trying to educate themselves. And so HBCUs existed to fill that need for Black people to be able to educate themselves. And so the first HBCU was founded in 1837. That was Cheney University. And the Divine Nine, I also thought that it was really important to include the Divine Nine. They are a group of nine Black fraternities and sororities that are a really integral part of the Black college experience. Most of them were founded on HBCU campuses. There are a couple, I believe, that were founded outside of HBCUs, but they're just a really important part of the Black college experience and Black culture, Black collegiate culture in general.
Right. And how many exist overall right now at this point?
There are a little over 100. The exact number kind of, it really depends, because in order to receive federal designation, the U.S. Department of Education has to deem that a school meets certain requirements. And there are some schools that end up losing accreditation, not because they weren't, you know, they don't meet the requirements, but just simply because they lost accreditation for a number of reasons. So, you know, it depends on who you ask. There's some people who will include all schools that at one point were deemed HBCUs. And there's some people that will exclude schools that have lost that designation. Obviously, there are some schools that have closed, but I think right now the number is right over 100.
And how many did you include in the book, and how did you decide to include these particular schools, these academic institutions of higher learning?
Yeah, so there are about 55 schools that were included. I really wish that I had, you know, had an opportunity to include all the HBCUs. I think that's the biggest, you know, feedback, critical feedback that I get from people who have read the book or purchased it. You know, we're so proud of our HBCUs and everyone wants their school to be included because it's, you know, we only include letters A through Z. And it's not an exhaustive list of schools. If I just decided to, you know, say A is for enlist all of the schools that start with an A, I could have done that. But I really wanted the book to be a book that told a story. And so I only had a few number of lines to do that. How did I choose? I was really looking at schools that would be able to tell that story. And obviously all of the schools have a really rich history. I also looked at the schools that had, you know, if not some really amazing story, like for instance, there's a school in Alabama, I believe called Oakwood University. And that school was actually built on the land that an enslaved man by the name of Dred Scott, he was sold and auctioned off on that land. And so those type of stories I really tried to include. I also looked at the population of the schools. So, you know, which schools have a large student body presence, just, you know, as a way to try to reach as many HBCU alum or those communities as possible.
Now, backing up to what you just mentioned regarding HBCUs and the importance or the significance of it, at one point in time, they offered the only path to a college degree for Black students. However, those pathways have since increased outside of the traditional spaces or HBCUs. Yet, you believe that this institution, these institutions still serve a very important purpose. Maybe you can talk specifically about that purpose.
Absolutely. You know, it's wonderful that there's more than one pathway, right, to an education and that schools are now integrated, but there are a couple issues. I think if we look at predominantly white institutions, there has been, you know, a lot of feedback from students about the lack of inclusivity, the lack of diversity. Oftentimes at predominantly white institutions, there may be one house, one dorm home that is that designated safe space for students of color. Or perhaps it is joining the Divine Nine, pledging a Black Greek letter organization at a predominantly white institution that creates that safe space.
Right.
You know, during the summer, because of all of the uprisings and the social unrest, there were a lot of not just predominantly white colleges, but predominantly white schools, high schools around the country, where on social media, you had students and even faculty that were posting about their experiences, just blatant racism, blatant discrimination. You know, you even had the students who were arrested. They had the police called on them because they fell asleep in the library or the main, you know, the main area in the dormitory. And so oftentimes those are experiences that African-American students experience when they attend predominantly white institutions. And it is incredibly important that, you know, we continue to support and honor our HBCUs. They absolutely still have an important place in, you know, in society and as part of our institutions of higher education because they are the original safe spaces. A lot of HBCU alum will tell you that they walked onto their campus with a sense of freedom. And HBCUs provide that type of nurturing environment. And they also really push you in ways that you might not have experienced unless you've had a teacher of color, an African-American teacher that really says, hey, I believe in you. I want to see more from you. Or why don't you try this? And as an educator, you know, I know that one of the main initiatives within education right now, when we look at, you know, providing culturally responsive instruction, it's also important to make sure that you have teachers and administrators and support staff that look like students so that they can, you know, help advocate and help implement change in support of our students. And so HBCUs, you know, I call them the original safe space, and they continue to serve a very important purpose even today.
Well, I think also what you're describing is the educational ethos of an HBCU, right? And this experience is so very important, but also besides that safe space, which is extremely important, we're talking about the mission of HBCUs. And it's a clear educational objective. You know, HBCUs are still havens for disadvantaged students. They are blazing STEM trails. They make college more affordable. They adequately staff the workforce and help graduates land jobs. They also use that in the areas that, when we think about race and class, especially here in the United States, is so very important. Something that you pointed out in the book, and that's why it was important for me just to mention the mission. When we think about J, ABCs of the HBCUs, you say J is for the 80% of Black judges who graduated from an HBCU like Jackson State in Mississippi. Talk a bit about that. When we think about the contribution of the HBCU experience to the network of Black professionals here in the United States.
Absolutely. You raise a really important point. I think, you know, again, I go back to my experience as an educator here in Oakland. And when you look at school systems around the country, when you look at the what they call the achievement gap between students of color, particularly Latinx students, African American students, and white students or Asian students, or when you look at the achievement gap between you know, students who live and go to school in under-resourced communities versus those that go to school in more affluent communities, the question always is, what do we need to do differently for our students? How do we get these students to achieve? And oftentimes it's through this lens that, you know, we've tried all these other things. Maybe, you know, maybe there's just no hope. You know, let's try another initiative. Maybe it's different type of curriculum. Maybe, you know, we need to bring in different types of books. Maybe we need to hire different types of instructors. Maybe we need to, you know, do some meditation, yoga. I mean, you see all different types of initiatives within the school systems. And my response is, well, when you look at HBCUs, they have been doing the work with students from across the board. You have students who, you know, are economically disadvantaged, and you have students who come from the most privileged backgrounds. And you're right. When you look at the statistics of students who are coming out of HBCUs, it is unmatched. 80% of judges, I believe the number is 80% of medical professionals, which include dentists and physician assistants and doctors, attended HBCUs. 50% of Black teachers attended HBCUs. In the STEM field, the number is around 40 to 50%. And so they're clearly doing something right. And, you know, I hope that at some point now that HBCUs are getting more attention because, you know, of people who are in positions of power that have really made a name for themselves. I think people are paying more attention to HBCUs, but I really hope that that trickles down to education, where these school districts and school systems start saying, wait a minute, maybe we can learn something. Instead of trying to reinvent the wheel, maybe we can learn from the centuries of work that Black colleges have been doing to churn out these thought leaders and change agents that are making, you know, incredible inroads, not just for their community, but for the country and for the world.
Considering what you just said, the hope is that people are in a space of they're taking these HBCUs and what they've been able to accomplish more seriously. Is that what you're suggesting or saying?
Absolutely. I mean, part of the reason that I wrote the book, and this book was, you know, 2 years in the making. So, the book was on my heart before we had, you know, Kamala becoming the vice president, or, you know, people started taking note of Stacey Abrams and Raphael Warnock. But I recognize, not just as an educator, but even my own experience growing up, I knew that for me, when I decided to make the choice of which college I wanted to attend, many people started to try to talk me out of attending an HBCU because there is this narrative, there is this misconception that they are not competitive schools, or that you would attend, but you would have a really difficult time getting recruited or to have employers take you seriously. And so my hope for the book is that, you know, reading the book, understanding the history, understanding the legacy, understanding the impact of those who come out of the schools, and looking, you know, as you said, at people like Kamala Harris or, you know, Oprah Winfrey, that they will say, wait a minute, maybe we've had our blinders on for a while, because this is not a new thing. This is not a trend. It's not a fad. HBCUs have existed since 1837, and the impact has been wide ranging and has been incredibly significant. So yes, my hope is that people begin to really take note of HBCUs and that they get the credit that they deserve.
How can our listeners go about getting the book and just learning more about HBCUs?
Of course. So they can go to my website. The website is hbcuprepschool.com. You can order copies of the book. We also have some HBCU flashcards for children. We have a lot of other great products that are in the works, so I'm excited to release those. And really the goal for my publishing company is to really just celebrate Black joy and Black culture for children through the books that we publish. So head to our website. You can follow us on Instagram, HBCU Prep School, and just really excited for the future of the book and all the young children that hopefully will be inspiring.
All right, Claudia Walker, thank you so much for this conversation today. And thank you so much for putting this together for all of us to enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you, Anita. I appreciate it.
Hard Knock Radio. East, west, north, south, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous. Speaking to the thugs, one love. We know where y'all at. Round Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415s bumping Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. And to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from these hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor cops. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard stop. Learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor cops. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard stop.
Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out Anita and Davey D.
Yeah, right, feel me.
Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bellevue.
Come on, check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't gone all in and ain't paid the cost for the fee? Ain't nothing made, they beats trying to eat to the belly from the steel gray beats. They bleed. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Saying peace to the lovers I lay with a please. Maybe some shade on your name in the street. You go.
Real Talk Radio. You are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast.
Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
Picasso,
what?
And Maya.
Who?
And my last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
Hey yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. As the largest traded food commodity in the world, seafood provides sustenance to billions of people worldwide. More than 3 billion people in the world rely on wild-caught and farmed seafood as a significant source of animal protein. So states the World Wildlife Fund, an assertion echoed by other organizations and UN entities, the only variable being whether that significant source is 10 or 20% of necessary consumption. Now add the continuing alarms raised over unsustainable and illegal seafood harvest, and you have a health crisis already in the making. The problem can be confronted by treaty regulation with enforcement against the national and private enterprise that flaunts this reality through indifference and overt practice in defiance of global public awareness, some isolated prosecution, some anecdotal confiscation and destruction of vessels, and imprisonment of outlaw fishers. The consumption paradigm rules. What I need, I take. What others need has no relevant meaning. This compulsion is not unique to fishing, or fossil fuel and toxin production, or plastic waste, or national interest, or personal behavior. The collective outcome threatens species, ecosystems, coastal areas and communities, trade and economic viabilities, and international relations. This relentless harvest of fisheries and more is the explanation for food insecurity as an international reality and point of confusion and conflict. If we cannot contain or transform this social behavior, we will need to look elsewhere for the protein required, and technology as an instrument of change has a respondent urgent purpose. The nexus between agriculture and aquaculture pertains, in that these two are manifestations of food production to scale, farming on land and sea, each with challenges as individual processes, each with synergies toward harmonic outcome. Both demand respect for the national environments that sustain them. Both face problems of waste and corruption of local utility. Both have disruptive social and political consequences. Both have international implication for finance and trade. Both can create the paradoxical dilemma of destroying today the very thing that sustains us tomorrow. Sound familiar? But both also have an interest in reformed application and best practice. Both can transform manufacturing processes and waste recycling toward alternative outcomes. Both can adopt alternative energy production, use biofuels, integrate distribution systems, reduce additives, modify production and packaging, institute labor reforms, and integrate their processes under a concept of environmental conservation, sustainability, political affirmation, social justice, community development, and successful provision of harvest and health worldwide. This is no impossible dream. Technology is aiding some of this change through practical invention, shared opportunity, access to more efficient accounting and traceability, and new research and discovery of less destructive processing and ingredients, and more constructive performance and products that pertain more directly to a world that can no longer afford unlimited consumption of essential resources, can no longer ignore the poisoned ground and water created, can no longer accommodate the injustice as measured in individual and community decline and local, national, and international unrest. If we think of agriculture and aquaculture as a social practice combined, with value not measured by calculations indifferent to responsible use and human consequence, if we can think of return on this value as cultural beyond commercial, of technological innovation beyond the shortcut and get-rich-quick mentality that characterizes venture, beyond the past and toward a path to the future, we would make a great leap forward through applied technology, secure and adequate food supply, and a revival of physical, psychological, and political health toward the realization of rescue. R for renewal, E for environment, S for society, C for collaboration, U for understanding, and E for engagement. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange and the Pacifica Network for use by college and community radio stations worldwide. Find us wherever you listen to podcasts and at worldoceanobservatory.org.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Portland.